Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today World Radio Magazine, the online version, for April 2009 in digest format. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editorial director, Richard S. Mawson, call W2VQ, and the editor is Nancy Cott, KOTT. Her call is WZ8C. This recording is a production of the Courage Andy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use might violate copyright laws. Handy Hemp may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham, that's one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. Again, handyham at courage.org. We have a fine website at www.handyham.org. We'll begin today in the editor's log. Again, the editor is Nancy Cott, W-Z-H-C. April showers bring May flowers and also heralds a tradition of spring cleaning. Being a pack rat, I can't throw anything away. I might need it later. My shack has become overflowing with stuff. There is a path to the computer and another to the rig. I find it to be cozy and comfortable. It feels like being in a nest or a cave. I usually listen to 20 meters while I'm answering email or doing computer work. The other day I heard an old friend and wanted to jump in and say hello. I couldn't scoot my chair across the floor because of some boxes I had temporarily placed there last month. The area in front of the rig was so cluttered that by the time I followed the cable from the rig and found the key and cleared a spot for a notepad, my friend was gone. Looking around at my cozy cave, I saw it as others, especially non-hems, would see it, a room overflowing with boxes, radios, papers, telegraph keys, and assorted ham memorabilia. When I have visitors over, they usually ask to see my shack, and I always make some excuse to avoid showing it. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Would your shack benefit from a spring cleaning? It seems like an insurmountable task, but I'm going to try to make my shack guest-worthy. I know there are other pack rats out there. Why don't you join me? Send in your before and after photos, stories of buried treasures you've forgotten about, storage and organizational tips, and we'll share them in an upcoming issue. I'll also keep you posted on my progress. You can even make some extra cash from selling items that you have packed away for future use, but we both know you will never do anything with them. If it's not worth selling, take a box of junk to your local club meeting and let it become someone else's clutter. You don't need it and can fill the space in the shack with something you can use, or just enjoy the extra room on the floor or table. The response to our World Radio Online has been overwhelmingly positive. Of course, people miss not having a paper copy to roll up and put in their back pocket. But seeing the photos in color and being able to read their favorite columns has made our readers happy. We are still working on making the size of the magazine file smaller to facilitate a shorter download time, as well as working on other technical issues to make it easier to navigate and read. One question that has been asked frequently is whether back issues of World Radio Online will be available. The answer is yes. There is a back issue button on the web page, and it will bring up past issues, starting with February 2009, which you can download or read online. The previous issue is available as a back issue when the new issue is available for download, usually the 20th of each month. And just think of the room you'll save by having an archive of World Radio Online available at your fingertips on your computer rather than in piles around the shack. Signed, Nancy Cott, WZ8C, WRO Editor, 7388. If you'd like to contact Nancy via email, you can use her call sign WZ8C at CQ-amateur-radio.com. Let's just bump along now toward the Newsfront, World Radio Online Newsfront. NCVEC QPC seeks input on revised tech exam. The Question Pool Committee of the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators is now reviewing the Element 2 Technician Class Question Pool. This is part of a regular process in which each question pool is reviewed on a four-year rotation. The next technical class pool will become effective on July 1, 2010. In preparation, the Question Pool Committee is seeking input from the amateur community concerning this revision. It is also accepting input in the form of new question topics, new questions, and suggestions for changes or deletions. If you have any comments or suggestions on the current Element 2 question pool, please contact Question Pool Committee Chairman Roel Anders. His call sign is K3RA, Kilo 3, Romeo Alpha. You can send via email to, in lowercase, qpcinput@ncvec.org. Or if you have online capabilities as well, you can look at the website www.ncvec.org/feedback.php. Guidelines for question formats are provided at the web address. The current technician examination syllabus and question pool can be found elsewhere at the same website. Next News Fund piece, Radio Club of America begins school outreach program. The Radio Club of America, RCA, has begun a new multifaceted outreach program to reach youngsters and late teens to interest them in technology careers and, in some cases, also in amateur radio. Retired New York City educator Carol Perry, WB2MGP, is in charge of the program and tells us a bit of what's being planned. What follows is a bit of dialogue. Perry, a dear friend of mine who is a fellow RCA member named Richard Summers on the West Coast, is going to mostly in the inner schools of Los Angeles searching for at-risk students who have some technical inclination but cannot afford after high school to pursue a trade or a vocation in anything technical as far as schooling goes. We are proposing giving these students, once they are identified, scholarship money which they will receive once they are enrolled or engaged in a technical or vocational trade school. As to recruiting new hams, that will first be explored in the Northeast. There, WB2MGP will fall back on something she knows quite well, teaching ham radio and putting ham gear in the classroom. Perry speaking again. The other move is to encourage amateur radio in as many schools as I can get into in my immediate area in the New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut area by going in and actually showing the track record of the successfully run ham radio program that I already have lined up and in place. Also, by offering them equipment that is going to be donated by fellow RCA members. Perry says that this equipment will be checked out and put into first-rate shape before it's delivered to the schools to create ham radio stations where now there are none. The program will also train the classroom educators on how to use ham radio as a classroom teaching tool. You can hear more about this very interesting project being headed up by Carol Perry, called WB2MGP, on this week's RAINT report. You can find it online at www.therainreport.com or by phone at area 773-358-7845. That news is thanks to Newsline. We have another interesting piece. ARRL approves limited use of CW Skimmer, S-K-I-M-M-E-R. A big change in a world of contesting. Following months of review, the ARRL has decided to allow the use of the controversial CW Skimmer program, but only for multi-ops and single-op radios using assistance in ARRL contests. The rules change on multi-channel decoders, like a CW Skimmer, was approved by the ARRL Program and Services Committee which met before the mid-January 2009 meeting of the ARRL Board of Directors. In an interview with Radiosport.net, ARRL Contest Advisory Committee Chairman Dick Green, called WC1M, said that this emerging technology will be permitted in ARRL Contest, but not in the single operator category. This decision mirrors a similar one made last year by the CQ Worldwide DX Contest. The ARRL decision means that all major contests have now dealt with the CW skimmer issue. We thank W0WI via VHF Reflector for the information. A last piece, ARRL issues mobile amateur radio policy statement. The idea of banning cell phone use or texting while driving is gaining support from police agencies and insurance companies. The ARRL board adopted a policy encouraging those backing these bans to exclude mobile amateur radio operations. The message is clearly aimed at state legislators and community leaders. The policy statement focuses on the concept that cell phones are full duplex devices, meaning the user is focusing on listening and conversing directly. Amateur radio communications, on the other hand, the policy statement notes, require more listening and less transmitting, and each cannot occur simultaneously. The ARRL is worried that regulating cell phones and text messaging while driving casts such a broad net that amateurs who provide public service could be blocked from lending a hand to their communities in times of need. You can read more at the League's website, www.arrl.org. The ARRL policy statement does recognize the responsibility of the amateur community to conduct its activities in a manner that does not create unsafe operation of their motor vehicles. It says that safety has to be a top concern at all times. We thank ARRL for that input. You know, folks, as I scan the pages to begin another piece, I see there's an announcement here that CPAC, PAC, the ARRL Northwest Division Ham Convention, is now scheduled for June 5, 6, and 7, 2009. And that's going to be at the Seaside Slant Pacific Ham Convention, Seaside Convention Center, Seaside, Oregon. I guess it's at Seaside, huh? So that's June 5, 6, and 7, few months from now. Please plan now to attend the Northwest's largest ham convention. They're going to have seminars, prizes, banquet, of course, banquets for ham operators, yes. DX luncheon, that's another yummy. YLRL luncheon, a dealer exhibit, VE testing. Manufacturer is going to try to sell you all kinds of fantastic gear. And there are expected to be over 100 flea market tables. Better get the bug spray out. So that's a CPAC convention in early June of this year. Up next is an article titled Avoiding the Scourge of DX by Ron Wren, W-R-E-N. Ron's call is W6D-F-T. Subtitled, Since the HF bands will soon be coming back to life and stations from all over the world will start popping into your receiver, even when you're just trying to talk with Ed across town, it's time to get prepared and learn how to deal with the inevitable. It's a subject that hams have feared to address, but it's time to face the issue. DX causes pileups. Pileups cause QRM, and QRM interferes with communication. No one wants QRM, so eliminating or minimizing DX contacts is the most sensible path to the full enjoyment of ham radio. Avoiding DX is not as easy as it seems, but the problem can be broken down into two basic concepts. One, receiving DX, and two, transmitting to DX. As one who has not worked DX in years, I consider myself somewhat of an expert on the subject, and it is with the best of intentions that I am willing to pass on my DX avoidance techniques. Now, here's a note. In all instances, I recommend our readers adhere to gentlemanly or womanly ham decor, masking any overtly negative act that would bring shame on our hobby. First, the issue of receiving DX. If a DX station insists on calling you, remember the cardinal rule. Never answer a DX station's call. Other hams on or near the frequency will thank you. Also, the DX station, used to being sought after by several thousand DX-chasing hams, will be properly chagrined. Let's say a YK station, for example, calls you, and you take pity on his efforts to make a contact. Answer in high school Spanish. A YK will immediately sigh and check the orientation of his beam. If making a DX contact is unavoidable, never give a 5-9. That only encourages the other fellow. The fact is most DX stations are 3x3, so be honest. Give them the report they don't want to hear. That should end the queue so quickly. Implied criticism has worked well to end domestic contacts, and the same technique can work just as effectively with DX. Subtly find fault with the other chap's transmission. There's some kind of crackling sound in the background. Could your radio be on fire? Suggest that he has a hearing problem by overly enunciating your call using the pedantic phonetics, even after he has it down perfectly. Confuse his call with another. For example, reply to a VE1 by calling him XE1 and commend him on his excellent English. Unwanted cues, domestic and DX, will be cut short, allowing plenty of time to pursue other interests. Transmitting techniques to avoid DX are an enviable skill to hone. Here's a technique that always works. Adjust your radio for cross-band operation. Receive a DX station on 20 meters, for instance, but transmit on 10. Now here's an editor's note. This technique may not necessarily fail when sunspots are active. Close editor's note. Now continuing with Ron Wren's commentary. Cut your power to 5 watts and load a grounded dipole. Should you, in spite of this, succeed in making an unwanted DX contact, you'll be written up in all the publications and receive a handsome award, suitable for framing. Make good use of your DX-100. Should an unfortunate DX station break in on an otherwise excellent local contact, sprinkle your conversation with references to crystals, 6L6s, and the advantages of rectifier tubes. Any self-respecting DX station will dump you in a minute. Non-responsive is an excellent way to end a DX, or for that matter, Eddie Cuso. Talk only about yourself, your rig, your life, your achievements. Never ask a question of the other operator. If your goal is to discourage a contact and do your part in cleaning up the airways, this approach will end any queue so fast. Finally, the surefire secret to avoiding DX. It's the one approach that assures that a DX station will not call you, that you'll have done your part to unclog the ether and the scourge of DX. Call CQDX. We thank Ron Wren, call W6DFT, for his sage advice in avoiding the scourge of DX. Let's move away now from DX and go to the Mars information. Not the planet Mars. Actually, military affiliate radio system. An inauguration at Mars. The author here is Bill Sexton, N1IN. His Mars call is Alpha 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 9 Papa Charlie. Like other federal emergency responders on January 20, Mars communicators were very ready should their services be needed during the inaugural ceremonies. It wasn't. And like most everybody in the Capitol, Mars members around the country were wondering if big change was headed their way, too. It is. Just before Inauguration Day, you could pick up hints of transformation in the formal alert notification that Army Military Affiliate Radio System commands received in the 5 states surrounding the District of Columbia. This communication support plan assigned Jim Sears, the Maryland State Director, to the position of Incident Commander. You might ask, Incident Commander? That's not Army language. That's FEMA talk. Then Tim Zutaut, the Region 3 Director, activated what he termed a TransCon style, HFNet, on Inauguration Day. TransCon? That's not Army either. It's the label Air Force Mars uses for its unique cross-country HF net, a model that would be particularly handy in any emergency situation spanning long distances. Please pardon the play on words, but it's change you can believe in when Army Mars leadership starts using FEMA and Air Force Mars language in organizing for a national security special event, as Homeland Security had proclaimed January 20. The explanation lies in a separate occasion unfolding at the very same time. On the day before Zutat broadcast his alert notification, a task force of senior Army Mars members completed drafting a new long-range plan for the whole organization and forwarded it to Chief Army Mars Stu Carter for consideration. Although the document hadn't been published as this was being written, it reveals no secrets to say that the plan defines partnership with other entities, FEMA and the Air Force Mars among the many, as the key to the Army Mars future. It most emphatically mandates retraining for the entire membership as the next step in that direction. As this is being read, the 2,700 members should be just beginning that intensive instruction. Such an unconventional approach to doctrine for the future departs from the military's top-down custom in a couple of ways. Chief Carter assigned the first draft to leaders in the field rather than headquarters, and he stipulated that they avoid the typical blueprint loaded with fragile fine print specifics. Rather, he wanted a roadmap focused on direction and priority instead of detail. That is, a navigation chart that would stand up regardless of the endless ebb and flow of revisions and updates that have prevailed in the MCON community ever since Hurricane Katrina. That's what the team gave him. As if to confirm the wisdom of his approach, in December, the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, issued a new edition of the National Incident Management System. This is the master document that guides all federal emergency response. If state and local agencies want federal funding, they too must conform. The new NIMS supersedes the version published the year before Katrina. A very cursory analysis suggests that the Army Mars drafting team, while not aware of the imminent FEMA rewrite, a fair disclosure, I was one of the seven participants, was operating on the same frequency as Washington. The new MIMS reorders the key components to emphasize the role of preparedness. The DHS announcement said, the former number one priority, command and management, drops to fourth place. Communications and information management, previously number four, jumps up to number two. Translation? Being ready and in touch is better than being in charge, but disconnected. Significance? Mars capabilities become all the more important, not least our incident notification task. Thus is the embarrassing Katrina experience clearly reflected in the agency's altered emphasis, as it is in the Army Mars Draft Plan 2. Our guiding document bears the title Army Mars, The Road Ahead. And of course, it is all about communications. It shares with NIMS a strong focus on training, which is one of the key preparedness subtopics in the NIMS document, as well as interoperability, which is internal to NIMS communications and information management. Section goes on in significant detail about various facets of the agreements and the changes that Mars is experiencing along with FEMA. If you'd like to contact Bill Sexton, you can reach him by snail mail, U.S. Postal Service, at Post Office Box 428, Richmond, Massachusetts, MA, 01254, or by email to call sign n1in@arrl.net. Well, I think it's time for a little bit of change of pace. Let's look at the hamfests and special events for the month of April into May. In California, the Valley of the Moon Amateur Radio Club called W6AJF Annual ARRL Hamfest. The Valley of the Moon Amateur Radio Club is holding its annual ARRL Hamfest Saturday, April 25th from 8 a.m. to noon. The Hamfest will be held at the Sonoma Valley Veterans Memorial Building, 126 First Street West, Sonoma, California. Admission is free, and hams are encouraged to bring the entire family. If you're looking to get your license or to upgrade, there will be a walk-in volunteer examiner session. Also, the club will serve a full breakfast from 8 to 10 a.m. for $6. The other side of the country, in Florida, Shark's Tooth Festival. The Tamiami Amateur Radio Club will operate special event station K4S, Kilo 4 Sierra, from the annual Venus Shark's Tooth Festival, April 17 through 19, 1300 to 2400 Zulu, or until bands close. Various frequencies, you should be able to catch them if you look around. North Carolina, the 19th annual Down East Ham Fest will be held April 5 at Lenoir Community College, located on U.S. 70 East at North Carolina 58 South, Kingston. Hours will be 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. Tickets are $4 each, or 3 for $10, and so forth. There will also be an FCC exam at 11 a.m., walk-in only. And there also are economical meals available on-site. Also in North Carolina, Catawba Valley Hamfest, 145 Boast Road, Morgantown, North Carolina. The gates will open at 8 a.m. on Saturday, April 18th. There will be amateur radio testing on-site. Tickets there are $4, pre-registration are $5 at the gate, parking is free, flea market set up with purchase of admission ticket, food available early. Now, the next one is actually in the month of May, in the state of Michigan, 47th Annual Cadillac Swap, Saturday sponsored by the Wacoxie Amateur Radio Club, Saturday, May 2nd at Cadillac Junior High School, 500 Chestnut Street, Cadillac, Michigan. Admission $5. Tables are 10. You can be talked in on 146.98, no PL. Commercial vendors and VE session information, you can contact Alton McConnell, 231-867-3774. So I'd suggest that for those of you in locales nearby to these special events and Hamfest, go out and get a little fresh air in springtime as well. As long as it isn't raining all over you. What do you say we take a look at some traffic? A new mission for NTS with a big question mark. The author is Jim Wades, W-A-D-E-S. Jim's call is W-B-8-S-I-W. Few would argue that the national traffic system has fallen on hard times. Interest has been slowly waning for years, as evidenced by the increasing age of many traffic handlers and a declining quality of traffic. In some areas, section nets have even failed. The ARRL has long since abandoned any serious commitment to promoting NTS. Modern advances in personal communications technology have led many to perceive the process of manually transmitting radiograms as irrelevant, regardless of the mode utilized. While serving in a variety of leadership capacities in the ARRL field organization, I have undertaken many efforts to promote and modernize NTS. The goal was always to promote the program as a training and preparedness tool while ensuring some level of relevancy. In particular, attempts to attract new traffic handlers by deploying newer digital technologies largely failed, as attempts to define new and unique public service missions for NETs. The reason for these failures have likely been many, ranging from petty politics to overly optimistic expectations, which ran counter to modern operating trends. One thing seems certain. New digital technologies will likely offer little promise for renewing NTS. After considerable thought, it seems there is only one option for restoring NTS to true viability. This option has little to do with new digital technologies. Rather, it defines a new mission for NTS. Advertising. The word is underlined. A-D-V-E-R-T-I-S-I-N-G. Advertising. In this modern day and age, advertisers invest large sums of money in direct advertising. Even nonprofits find they must invest significant sums in advertising to ensure their brand will stand out above the modern media noise floor in order to attract investment and support. Ultimately, the goal of an effective advertising campaign is to reach the most likely consumers of a product or service at the least cost. Attaining a reasonably cost-benefit ratio is done by targeting specific demographics with relevant and attractive information. Traditional advertising methods are not an option for amateur radio. We cannot hope to develop the revenue necessary to match an advertising campaign of the type often developed for a major relief organization or a well-known nonprofit. However, amateur radio has a variety of tools available, which are ideal for a direct marketing campaign even Madison Avenue could appreciate. These tools include NTS and tens of thousands of volunteers. Every time a traffic handler delivers a radiogram to a third party, he or she is engaged in marketing. Unlike spam or unwanted bulk mail, the message content and originator provide a valuable direct connection to the targeted party, that's the addressee. This is a direct connection which opens a door to the addressee, which few advertisers can ever hope to enter. Unfortunately, there are a few flies in the ointment when it comes to the traditional radiogram delivery process. First, many individuals are naturally uncomfortable with telephone calls from strangers. This natural barrier is reinforced by decades of abuses by telemarketers, collection agency bullies, and automated political promotions. Just as many dislike calls from strangers, many radio amateurs are also uncomfortable with the process of telephoning a stranger to deliver a message. Traditional alternatives, such as delivery by postal service, result in a significant delay and expense. Fortunately, the answer is right before us in the form of email. Today, email is the preferred method of communications for a large number of Americans. Most individuals are quite happy to accept a wide range of information, ranging from humorous messages to serious communications from friends, family, and business associates. By utilizing email for radiogram delivery, one solves many problems. First, there is no need for an uncomfortable direct contact via telephone. Second, there is no expense associated with the process. Third, the use of email opens a valuable door to marketing opportunities. Imagine an HTML form identical to the traditional yellow and green paper radiogram form, which could be populated with all the same information. When opened, the addressee would see a traditional radiogram-style message. However, included with the message would be a variety of additional features. For example, point. An email link could be provided allowing the addressee to submit a reply through the delivering station. Point. A link could be provided to a national webpage which promotes amateur radio such as the ARRL www.helloradio.org webpage. Point. An additional link could be customized to take the addressee to a local radio club webpage or similar resource with information on how to get involved in amateur radio. Point. A variety of information on the role of amateur radio in emergency communications could be provided directly beneath the radiogram form. Point. Some history of the amateur radio service and its contributions to the development of radio communications could also be included. Essentially, every radiogram delivered would serve as a targeted direct contact advertisement. Unlike spam, which is relatively ineffective because it replaces the benefits of targeted specific demographics with simple quantity, each radiogram delivered would take advantage of a direct personal connection to the addressee, greatly increasing acceptance and effectiveness. All that would be necessary to make such a system work would be for an organization to develop a simple web tool which would allow an operator to transmit such a form within the framework of an email. Of course, some will suggest that it is silly to send a message via NTS simply to have it delivered via email. This is, of course, a fallacy of logic. The same could be said of a public switching telephone network today or the Western Union of yesterday. The training value of NTS would remain, and the network would remain intact and available for emergency communications functions in the event of a widespread emergency. Telephone delivery would remain an option for welfare, priority, and other time-sensitive messages in summarization. Ultimately, it would not matter how the message is conveyed. Whether sent by CW, voice, or data, the routine radiogram's purpose would become one of marketing ham radio. In a process, National Traffic System could perhaps once again play a significant role in training radio amateurs to handle real third-party traffic. The work is signed by Jim Wades, WB8SIW. I'm going to move on now to 1010 International. This one is simply titled Numbers, Numbers, Numbers. This 1010 column is being written by Keith Schlottman, called KT7RK, 1010 number 63324. Keith is also 1010 treasurer. Unless you have been ignoring current world events, you are probably growing weary of hearing the data barrage of huge numbers that come across the news screens. After a while, the billions and even trillions become meaningless. So I thought I'd take a few minutes to discuss some numbers that might be a bit easier to digest. One of the distinctive aspects of 1010 is that members are each given a unique membership number. To date, we have issued over 75,000 numbers, making our organization one of the largest ham radio groups in existence. It's the people behind the numbers who make 1010 special. But part of the fun comes from collecting those numbers to earn awards. Did you know that one number, called WA5JDU, has made contacts with over 24,600 of our members? We have had 1,558 members earn an award for making contacts with over 1,000 unique members. We all know that Cycle 24 has been slow in coming, but hopefully that does not mean you have given up on the bands. Last year I was able to make several hundred QSOs with 1010 members. Many members are using PSK31 to make QSOs under weak signal conditions. Working 1010 QSO parties is an excellent way to build your numbers. Speaking of building numbers, last year 1010 added approximately 500 new members to our ranks. 1010 is one of the best ham radio values around, with annual dues of just $15, or $18 if you happen to be a DX entity. We have multi-year renewal discounts and life memberships that can reduce the dues even further. Careful planning and budgeting by the 11-member volunteer board of directors has allowed 1010 to maintain reasonable dues rates. You won't find any big bonus 1010 officials seeking a bailout. How do we spend that dues money? First and foremost has always been to produce a quality 32-page newsletter published four times per year. We also use dues to support our website and to set up booths at various TAM radio conventions. 1010 dues also support numerous award programs, and there are 15 different volunteer award managers. Here's a number that everyone will like. Zero. All of our awards are free for 1010 members. 1010 currently recognizes 80 different chapters. These local groups of 1010 supporters are found all over the world, and most have nets. A list of chapters and net times can be found on the 1010 website. Our website was recently updated, and according to the webmaster, we had over 25,000 hits in the first couple of months after the update. And a reminder for those interested, the 1010 convention will be held in Orlando, Florida, on 23 through 26 July 2009. There will be a large number of 1010 members there, and I hope you join in on the fun. Here's a little miscellaneous. 1010 will be at the Dayton Hamvention and Hamcom this year. Come say hi, sign a log, and see what's happening with 1010. At Dayton, we will be in booth 486, north of the ARRL area, and at Hamcom, we will be located along the Eastern Corridor with the other organizations. The easiest way to obtain information about 1010 is to visit the 1010 website at www.ten-ten.org. Everything you want to know about the organization is on the web, including the downloadable membership application form. If you do not have computer capabilities, you can receive a copy of the 1010 news by writing to 1010 International Net, P.M. B, 142, 643 North 98th Street, Omaha, Nebraska, N.E., zip code 68114. Please enclose $2 to cover the cost of shipping. Well, folks, you're listening here on the Carr Janahan system to the April 2009 reading of World Radio Online. My name is Bob Zeta. My call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right near good old New Bedford, on Buzzards Bay, heading toward marvelous Cape Cod. I'm going to attempt now another rather easy-to-read article in this issue. It's in the category of DX World. Now, for those of you not familiar with DX, that simply means that any nation, country outside of the continental United States would be considered DX. Canada, if it's outside of our location here, is DX. In fact, so is Alaska and Hawaii, even though they're part of the United States. They're not part of the contiguous United States. Well, anyway, this one is titled Low Band DXing from Modest Stations. The author, Kelly Jones, call N0VD. As winter begins drawing to a close and warmer weather starts to make its appearance, the low band DXing season also begins to wind down. With the lack of sunspots and high band doldrums, many of us have taken to the lower bands in search of that elusive DX. However, one of the major challenges of being a low band DXer is being able to get an effective antenna on these bands. Moreover, unfortunately, the challenge is inversely proportional to the frequency. A couple of years ago, I made a concerted effort to get something on the air for 160 meters. In 20-plus years of being licensed, 160 was the only HF band that I had not operated. For years, I used a 26-foot-tall vertical that covered 40 and 80 meters with some degree of success. While this little vertical played well on 40, it was pretty much an air-cooled dummy load on 80. However, I will admit that even though it wasn't the most effective player on 80, I did manage to work DXCC with it. Translated, that means 100 nations outside of the contiguous United States. Shortly after that accomplishment, plans were made to figure out how to get on 160 meters. After speaking with some of the local DXs who were active on 160, it was decided that due to my somewhat limited space, the best option for me would be to shunt feed my tower. Given that the tower was only 40 feet tall, we knew it would be a compromised antenna. Nonetheless, it would at least be something that would get me on the band. Something was better than nothing. That was in the fall of 2006, during the first season, roughly October through April. 71 DXCC entities were put in the log on 160 meters off from the black hole of Colorado. To date, I've managed 94 entities and have a goal to finish out DXCC by the time this year's season is over. By almost any definition, my low-band antenna arrangement is modest for operating on 160 meters. If I can get DXCC from my RF challenge location, I wondered how many others were using similar stations. Remember the adage about the inverse relationship of antennas to frequency? Were other DXs on the low bands using modest antennas as well? Reese Stimkowitz, SP5EWY, that's a Polish station, commented about how he has managed on low bands over the years. As any city dweller can relate, he points out the abundance of noise pollution. We're quoting him now. I've been on top band, that's the 160 meters, for many years, starting in 1987 in Warsaw, where I used to live a 10-story building. Of course, I had flat on 10th floor. I was using two-time 40-meter slopers from the top of the building to the street lamp. The power was about 500-watt input. I lived there for 2 years. During that time, I worked about 150 DXCC entities on 160 meters. However, because of a high level of noise in the city, I decided to move out of Warsaw. In 1990, I built a house 25 kilometers from the center of Warsaw. The property was rather small, only 30 meter by 30 meter. Because of that, I have only a few long radials. Most of them are only 10 to 15 meters long. Of course, the main problem on 160 meters is receiving, especially with such a small lot. For many years, I've been using K9AY loops, which are still my main receiving antennas. However, during the winter months, I am able to use two short beverages, about 250 meters long. But because they are on a public land, quite often I find them broken or damaged. Now back to the writer. I'm sure many will relate to Rye's comments about receiving. When you start chasing DX on the lower bands, finding some type of receive antenna that can help reduce noise, both atmospheric and man-made, adds to the challenge. It seems that every electronic gadget these days, from lamps to televisions to cell phone chargers, emits some sort of RF hash. However, experimenting with different types of small lot receive antennas can pay huge dividends in the end. As Rees mentioned, the various incarnations of the K9AY loop seem to be very popular and can be installed in tight quarters. I used to have a Delta loop for 80 meters. This was vertically polarized, hung from a 75-foot aluminum pole in the center of the tree, poking out of the top and fed a quarter wave down from the top on one of the sides of the triangle. This worked magnificently, but as you may be aware, the United Kingdom has draconian planting laws that mean you can't put anything up, even in your own garden, without a remote bureaucrat's permission. The bureaucrats made me take down the loop and aluminum pole after an evil, interfering, busybody, old witch of a neighbor complained. So unless I try to shunt feed one of my towers, I have to be a bit sneaky and hide low-profile wire antennas. The challenge of amateur radio operators. So concluding now, as we head into warmer weather, I hope that you might start thinking about how you could get on the lower bands or how to improve your signal. There are many creative ways for getting on those bands, as we have seen this month. Whether it is a wire out to the light pole or up the middle of the tree in the backyard, a shunt-fed tower, or a dipole strung around your yard, working DX on the low bands can be addictive and very certainly invoke a sense of pride and accomplishment. With that, I hope to see you down there next season. That's it for this month's column. I look forward to hearing your comments, complaints, whatever's on your mind. A special thanks to SP5EWY, K8KW, and G0OIL for sharing their low-band DXing experiences. If you have a story or opinion you would like to share, please send it to me at n0vd, Victor Delta, at DX Central. So that's n0vd at DXCENTRAL.com. I'll do my best to include it in my next column. Until then, see you in a pileups. And we thank Kelly Jones, November Zero, Victor Delta, for the writing. Well, I think I'll coast in with emergency communications. The title here is Information and Integrity. The author, Jerry Wellman, called W7SAR. Information is powerful. Wars are fought over information access. Fortunes are made with information. People are jailed for improperly revealing information. You and I exist to relay information. It's our bread and butter. Information is critical in saving lives if the information is timely and correct. The message may say there is an accident victim at the corner of State and Main, but the information may not save a life when it is realized by a responding medic that State and Main do not intersect. Last week I was listening to a Net via Echolink discussion on the net concerning the upcoming inauguration of then-President-elect Barack Obama. A number of agencies were using the historic event to test communications channels and wanted to be ready in case there were any problems. I received several notices via email that invited me to participate in various nets and to test connectivity. None of the notices said anything about an, quoting, emergency or, quoting, terrorist threat or even, quoting, let's be prepared for a disaster. Yet here I was, listening to this net about the upcoming inauguration, and one station said, and I quote, President Bush has declared a federal emergency for the inauguration. The station sharing this info nugget said it with just enough emotion and voice inflection to introduce some element of urgency, and the net members responded, an emergency? We must hold a net and be ready for emergency traffic. We will need stations to monitor all day and be ready to respond. In short order, a frenzy had been established. I, too, was caught up in the emotion. I heard nothing in the media reports of an elevated threat level or impending doom. Did this operator have inside information? Was he privy to a threat not known by the rest of us? So I did an internet search. There it was, a New York Times report confirming that President George Bush had declared an emergency for the inauguration. But the declaration was to enable the local Washington, D.C. leaders the ability to have additional funding to help deal with expected large numbers of people. It was a move to assist with paying the cost of having a larger-than-normal crowd on hand for an historic event. I was mad. I expected an emergency. I wanted to take the day off and be ready to respond, from Utah, no less, to an emergency. Why did this individual feel the need to share partial information and in such a manner that his voice, tone, and inflection inferred something ominous was in the offering? Did he feel the need for attention? Was he trying to drum up support for an emergency net? I don't know. What I do know is that he damaged his reputation. If you want to establish amateur radio as a viable and credible resource in the emergency community, let's simply provide what we promise, reliable communications in a timely manner. When we leave out bits and pieces or add voice inflections that serve to alter the information at hand, we only discredit ourselves. Let's not create emergencies where none exist. Isn't there a story about that crying wolf? Before you press the microphone button for that MCOM net moment, check your sources, give the complete message, and perhaps evaluate your own motivation for thinking you have something of value to contribute. I was told of an event recently where an amateur operator of complete integrity worked for years to be invited to an inner circle of his area's law enforcement. He had established himself as a person of trust and as someone dependable and as someone representing a group, for example, amateur radio, of value to the agency. After years of gaining trust, the group was privy to information that was perhaps not top secret, but considered sensitive to the local agency. Can you imagine what happened when that information found its way, via one of the radio group's members, to a public discussion forum on the Internet? No need to speculate. The group was uninvited by the local agency. Net result of several years' hard work to gain trust, a step back many years. In the MCOM world, trust is a heady thing. When you've been granted access to the EOC, or the Inner Planning Circle, you've hit the big time. I was seen leaving a rather high-level meeting one afternoon, and a coworker asked me why I had been there. I was invited, I said. He then asked what happened at the meeting. I said I could not tell him, and that was why I'd been invited. Some years ago, I was a desk editor for a Salt Lake City newspaper. I was able to assign reporters and photographers and make decisions about how we played news stories. I was also active as a parent with some mental health initiatives for children. One afternoon, I was asked to serve on an agency board. I would have access to all kinds of sensitive information. Some of this information had been on the newspaper's radar screens for years. I cleared the request to serve with my boss, the publisher, and went to an interview with the agency chief. She asked me if I could keep confidences. She asked me if I could safeguard information I might have access to. I assured her I could. She then warned me that she knew I was a newspaper editor, and that if I leaked information to anyone, I'd not be given a second chance. I'd be dismissed from the board. I served for 2-year term, and it was a fun time. Several years later, I bumped into the agency chief. She came and thanked me. I was trying to remember what I'd done that was noteworthy. She explained that during my tenure, I'd held true to my word and had not disclosed information. She explained that she'd gone to bat and had been subjected to a fair amount of criticism for me serving on the board, and because I'd been trustworthy, she'd been vindicated in her decision. Then she added that my boss, the publisher, lived next door to her, which I had not known. She said she asked him on several occasions if I'd mentioned details of board meetings. He assured her that I'd been true to my word as well. Here's the rest of the story. Because I didn't reveal information that the newspaper had sought for years, my boss realized I could be trusted, and it helped my career at the paper. I could have had instant and short-term fame and attention at the paper by sharing confidences. In the long run, it was a wise career choice. Moral of the story? The price of short-term fame is often a trade-off for long-term benefits. Again, consider your motivation before you share confidential information. In the emergency communications field, you need long-term trust. Don't jeopardize it one day and complain the next when you're not invited to play. Agency officials tend to have long memories. Well, folks, that's sort of a summarized commentary on emergency communications, information, and integrity by author Jerry Wellman, called W7SAR. I'm just about up to time, but I owe you an apology. You may be hearing a little bit of popping noise, a little bit of what sounds like muffled clacks and so forth and so on. I'm working on a temporary computer situation right now. My main job is not feeling well, but I want to get the information out. And I also don't have a screen on my little microphone. And when you don't have a screen, a windscreen, call it what you want, sometimes you hit certain P's and other little notes, and you get a pop sort of a thing. So I'm apologizing profusely for that as well. I also want to thank all of you, not just for myself, my volunteer efforts, but also for the fine work and cooperation with the Courage Handy Hemp System, where we provide this information for those who are not able to read it themselves. You've been listening to World Radio Online for April 2009. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. You can call them at area 516-681-2922 anytime to ask questions or to subscribe to various publications provided by CQ Communications Incorporated. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hems may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyhem, one word, handyhem@courage.org. We have a fine website at www.handyhem.org. And if you become a member of Handy Hems, it's a very minimal amount, and if you can't afford it, talk to them anyway. I'm sure they'll arrange for it. And if you have email capabilities, you'll get a great Handy Ham newsletter every Wednesday. A great deal of information about all the newest technologies for people who are sight impaired or just simply can't read for various and sundry reasons that will help you get along in life a lot more easy than you perhaps are at the present time. Again, I state, this is Bob Zeta. My call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo, Lima, Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're about 50 miles south of Boston in southeastern Mass, right on Buzzards Bay. About 7 miles offshore, if I threw a good long strike, I could hit Martha's Vineyard. Hi, hi. That's where we are. Thanks a lot for listening along. And if you'd like to comment to me directly, by all means, please do, good, bad, or otherwise. I appreciate any input that may help to make my productions for you better than they have been. So, my email is my call sign, N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot, at comcast.net. N1BLF at comcast.net. 73s, 88. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.